This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In one sense, the case of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg ended 50 years ago with their executions in the electric chair at Sing Sing Prison. Ever since, though, the debate has continued over what they did and why, about the reasons for their executions, and about the key witness against them, Ethel Rosenberg's brother, David Greenglass. Technically, the charge was conspiracy to commit espionage. In effect, the Rosenbergs were accused of providing the design for the atomic bomb to the Soviet Union. Given the stakes involved and Cold War passions, it's no exaggeration to describe this as the trial of the century. In this supercharged case, consensus is harder than usual to come by, but most historians agree that both of the Rosenbergs were committed communists, that Julius was a spy, and that his brother-in-law provided information on the bomb that Rosenberg sent on to Moscow. Most historians also question the extent of Ethel's involvement in espionage and whether the U.S. government sought and applied the death penalty even though officials knew that the case against her was flimsy. And in the past few years, it's also become clear that another American spy provided Moscow with far more damaging information on the bomb and got away with it. Later in this program, we'll get a political definition of the term revisionist history. President Bush used the phrase yesterday to respond to criticism over Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. And we'll talk with the director of a new documentary about another tangled case, this one involving charges of child abuse, capturing the Freedmans. But first, the Rosenbergs 50 years later. If you have questions about the case and its place in American history, you can give us a phone call. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now is Sam Roberts. He's deputy editor at the New York Times and author of the book The Brother, The Untold Story of the Rosenberg Case, which has just been reissued in paperback. He joins us from our bureau in New York, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you very much, Neil.
Tomorrow marks the 50th anniversary of the execution. A lot of time has gone by. Many of us have forgotten the details, or some may not have known them at all. So perhaps we should start with the question you asked in your article in this past weekend's New York Times. Yes, they were guilty, but of what exactly?
Good question. They were guilty. Certainly Julius was guilty. And I think you summarized the case pretty darn well. Julius Rosenberg was a spy. He was a communist. He did pass on military and technical industrial information to the Soviets. Keep in mind that the Soviets, for the most part, were an ally of the United States at the time in World War II. That, as the government attested in the trial, did not give him the right to pass on that information. It was mostly classified, some of it top secret. He also recruited his brother-in-law to obtain atomic information. David Greenglass was an army machinist stationed at Los Alamos. He was the brother of Ethel Rosenberg, and he did pass on certain information. I think it's clear now that the Russians would have built their bomb whether he had passed on that information or not. But again, the charge against them was conspiracy to commit espionage, and the government did not have to prove that any information of value was actually passed on. This once again tells us the danger of conspiracy charges, something we're seeing again today. Also the danger of the death penalty, because the death penalty was imposed on Ethel Rosenberg almost solely as leverage against her husband. The idea was to make him talk, to make him confess, to make him implicate others who were involved in the conspiracy. And it was interesting because shortly before he died, I interviewed William Rogers, who was the Deputy Attorney General of the United States at the time. And I quote him in the book. I said, "Didn't everything wind up going the way you wanted it to? You indicted the Rosenbergs, you got them sentenced, convicted, executed." And he said, "No, what we really wanted was for them to talk." And I said, "What went wrong?" And he said, "Ethel Rosenberg called our bluff." And what that means, in effect, is the top law enforcement official of the United States admitted that the government was bluffing when it indicted her and prosecuted her and ultimately put her to death 50 years ago tomorrow.
And obviously left two small children behind.
Left two small children behind, and that was one of the reasons that, among others, J. Edgar Hoover said, don't execute Ethel Rosenberg, because what you wind up doing is, no matter what you do in terms of the criminal justice system, you will lose the propaganda war. And I think it's fair to say that certainly Ethel Rosenberg, and perhaps the Rosenbergs collectively, turned out to be much more valuable to the Russians as martyrs than they ever were as spies.
Now, the key to the case, as the title of your book suggests, is the brother, David Greenglass. And again, consensus on this story is hard to find anywhere, but I guess everybody on all sides finds, well, you could pick your adjective, contemptible?
Well, that's one. Woody Allen had the joke, and I think Crimes and Misdemeanors, I love him like a brother, David Greenglass. I'm not sure how many people got the joke at the time, but it was indicative of what people should think or do think of David Greenglass. Rebecca West, in her New Meaning of Treason, described the ugly act, the hostile twin of incest, she called it, of a brother testifying against his own sister in a capital case like this. He testified, he said, honestly, at the time, to save himself. He was not sentenced to death, unlike the Rosenbergs. He was sentenced to 15 years in prison and served 10, and his wife was spared any prosecution at all.
Well, interviewed him and recorded some of your conversations, and I'd like to play an excerpt of that conversation that you had with David Greenglass, obviously many years afterwards, and this is how he described it to you when he was approached by the FBI as to what he was going to, what his feelings were at that moment.
When I talked to them, I said, give you the story, but my wife has to be completely honest.
Right.
And that's what they adhere to that promise, so I adhere to my promise. Look, I had a wife and two children. I didn't really care that much about what happened to me, but I sure as hell cared about what happened to them.
The voice of David Greenglass speaking with Sam Roberts in the process of writing his book called The Brother. That's a pretty self-serving statement, isn't it?
It is a self-serving statement, and he's a pretty self-serving guy. Neil, I spent about 13 years tracking him down and persuading him to talk. He had not really talked at all since he got out of prison in 1960. And I asked a number of people what the loose threads were in the case. Ron Radosh and Joyce Milton did a very good book on the case back in 1983. There were still unanswered questions. One of the unanswered questions was the role of David Greenglass. And when I finally tracked him down, I asked him about the key piece of evidence he delivered on the witness stand, that Ethel Rosenberg typed his notes about the atomic bomb to be transferred to the Russians. And it was a very crucial piece of evidence, because when the prosecutor was summing up for the jury, the prosecutor said that Ethel Rosenberg sat at that typewriter and blow by blow struck the keys against her country. And the jury was later asked why they believed Ethel Rosenberg rather than her brother David Greenglass, or vice versa, why they believed David. And they said a brother would never testify against his sister untruthfully. Well, David admitted to me in the course of our interviews for my book that he lied, that in fact he didn't remember whether or not Ethel typed the notes or not.
And
we have that clip
of tape too. Let's listen
okay,
to that.
Okay, let's hear that.
All right, go ahead. Let's play this clip.
You were asked about the typing, whether Ethel did the typing, and you said you never remembered it then or now.
I don't remember that at all. I frankly think my wife did the typing, but I don't remember.
And he didn't remember it at the time of the trial?
No, I didn't remember it then either.
Right. Yet he provided the damning testimony.
He provided the damning testimony. And, Neil, what makes it so interesting is that what happened was Ruth remembered the typing in an interview with FBI agents about 2 weeks before the trial was actually supposed to begin, well after they were arrested. Now, none of us, I think, will ever know whether, in fact, Ethel Rosenberg typed those notes or not. But the point is that if David Greenglass had told the truth, if he had gone on the witness stand and said, I don't remember whether my sister did the typing, then I don't think she ever would have been convicted, much less executed. And he lied, in effect, as I point out in the book, about the single most incriminating piece of evidence against his own sister.
We're talking about the Rosenberg case, 50 years after their execution. The 50-year anniversary is tomorrow. Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. We're speaking with Sam Roberts, who's the author of The Brother. And let's go to Larry, who joins us on the line from Fremont, California.
Good afternoon. I wanted to ask, to what degree can we trust the lead KGB documents as regards the Rosenbergs. I've been generally very dubious about these KGB documents because the KGB was infiltrated very thoroughly by the CIA, just like the CIA was infiltrated by the KGB. Strangely enough, when you look at these leaked KGB documents, they sound like they came from the John Birch Society or something. You know, they're so extremely they express that extreme conspiratorial view that the right wing had of communism. They seem like they confirm that view.
Well, Larry, it's a very good question because the FBI and the KGB were sort of equally paranoid at the time. There have not been very many KGB documents themselves that have come out. What we have is the testimony in his own book by Alexander Feklisov, who was a KGB agent, that Julius Rosenberg was not only a spy but a very valuable spy to the Soviet Union. We also have the Venona documents released by the National Security Agency of the United States that suggest that indeed he was a spy, although interestingly enough suggest that Ethel Rosenberg was not. So when you take all the documents together, they do paint a picture that pretty much correlates, that pretty much corroborates what we seem to know. We have not yet seen those KGB documents, the full file from the Russians. When we do, I think they'll probably tell us a lot more, but again, we should not take them at full value.
Larry, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Let's go to another caller. Henry is on the line from Lake Tahoe in California.
Good morning. How you doing?
Good afternoon here, but go ahead.
Listen, two questions, please. One, what position did Rosenberg have that allowed him access to this information? And two, if he were tried in federal court, why was he not executed by federal means?
Okay, two good questions. Henry, he had access to technical and military information because he worked for the Army Signal Corps at the time as an inspector. Also, as a graduate of City College, he had many friends who worked as engineers for the government, for the military, for the Navy Department, for General Electric, for lots of other firms that were military contractors. David Greenglass had access to atomic information, not the highest level, but enough to corroborate information that the Russians were getting from other sources, because he was an army machinist at the time stationed at Los Alamos, where the Manhattan Project was underway. Your second question about the electric chair, I don't believe the federal government had a death chamber at the time. So, in effect, they contracted with the state of New York to keep the Rosenbergs at Sing Sing prison and ultimately to execute them there 50 years ago tomorrow.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Henry. One of the things that you mentioned, Sam, is they did have other sources at Los Alamos, and we only found out about Ted Hall a couple of years ago.
We did. Ted Hall was a Soviet agent. He was not prosecuted, in part because most of what the government had on him, most of the information that was accusatory, came from those Venona transcripts, the cables that the NSA had deciphered at the time, that Army intelligence had deciphered. And the government did not want to compromise that information. It was probably hearsay and couldn't be introduced in court anyway. So he was never prosecuted. He was certainly under investigation, ultimately moved to England, ultimately in a book by Joseph Albright and Marcia Kunstler, confessed, in effect, or came close to it, that he was a spy. And interestingly enough, the night of the Rosenberg execution, he and his wife were driving past Sing Sing prison. They were visiting friends. He worked, I think, at Memorial Hospital at the time in New York City. They were visiting friends, and he and his wife said to each other, "My God, there, but for the grace of God, go us."
We're talking about the fate of Ethel and Julius Rosenberg, who were executed 50 years ago. What do you know or remember about the Rosenberg? Was this case important to you as you grew up? We're taking your phone calls, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. And given the weight of evidence that's come out over the past few years, have you changed your mind? Our email address is totn@npr.org. Our guest is Sam Roberts. His book is The Brother, The Untold Story of the Rosenberg Case. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about the Rosenberg case. 50 years ago tomorrow, Julius and Ethel Rosenberg were executed at Sing Sing Prison after they were convicted of conspiracy to commit espionage, in effect, for giving the design for the atomic bomb to the Soviet Union. Our guest is Sam Roberts. He's the author of The Brother, The Untold Story of the Rosenberg Case. Our phone number, if you'd like to join our conversation, is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and our email address is TOTN at NPR.org. And Sam Roberts, as a six-year-old child, you attended the funeral of the Rosenbergs. And in your book, you talk about how much the Rosenberg case was the inescapable topic, and yet two bedrock questions, as you describe them, were avoided assiduously. How could the Jews have done this to America? How could America have done this to the Jews?
I think those were the two questions that lots of people were asking at the time, particularly if you were Jewish and growing up in New York City. I was 6 years old. This occurred the day after my sixth birthday, in fact. And my father walked me to the corner of our neighborhood in Brownsville in Brooklyn to see the Rosenberg funeral procession go by. Not so much as a political statement, I think, but as one that this is history, this is something you should see, this is something you should remember. And anti-Semitism, or the question of Jewish participation, was immersed in the case from the very, very beginning. Not only were the defendants Jewish, of course, some of the witnesses were too, but the prosecutors and the judge were. That was no coincidence. And on the very night of the execution, which 50 years ago was a Friday night, the execution was pushed up from 11 o'clock to 8 o'clock at night to avoid any conflict with the Jewish Sabbath. And as Arthur Miller, the playwright, wrote, they were executed more quickly to avoid the shadow of bad taste.
You also have another quote about the case at the beginning of your book. You describe, I think the quote is, the Sacco and Vanzetti case united the American left. The case of the Rosenbergs divided them.
The case of the Rosenbergs did divide the American left because people really didn't know what to do with it, and people even to this day don't. And you see divisions politically that endure to this day. Not only did it precipitate and perpetuate McCarthyism, if you will, but it also did the Cold War. And when I began this book, I realized it was a story about, as you said, what J. Edgar Hoover called the trial for the crime of the century. I didn't realize that it would turn out to be a stinging indictment against the death penalty as well, that it would be about blind loyalty, about national hysteria, about civil liberties, about vulnerability to enemy attack, about family and love and betrayal, all the issues that resonate so deeply in society today, particularly after 9/11. And people are still divided. If people had told the truth then that, yes, there are communists in America, and yes, some of them have infiltrated the government, and if the government had told the truth and said, yes, there are communists, not everyone is a communist, not every communist is a Soviet spy, and that Ethel Rosenberg, to the best of our knowledge, was not a Soviet spy, even though we indicted her and executed her, I think a lot of those divisions would probably not be enduring until today.
I think it was Senator Moynihan before he died. But he spoke rather eloquently about how the country probably would have been better off. Yes, Venona would have been compromised, access to codes. The loss would have been significant in terms of intelligence gathering, but that the country would have been much better off if Venona had been publicized at the time that the transcripts were decrypted. So,
Neil, I think Moynihan was right about that. A lot of people would have challenged them. A lot of people would have said, as they do now, that they're incomplete, that they have been revised many times, that we don't know for sure those are the precise translations, but it would have shown that the government had some other source of evidence or claim to that showed that Julius Rosenberg was guilty, that other people were guilty of infiltrating the American government on behalf of the Soviet Union, and among other things, that Ethel Rosenberg did not appear to be guilty.
Let's go now to Charlie, who's on the line with us from Los Angeles.
Yes, it's a pleasure to talk to you, Neil. I think Mr. Roberts brought up some of it. McCarthy wasn't entirely wrong then. I mean, he was an evil guy that he accused some people wrongly, but it was true that we were being infiltrated, and a lot of people just blindly said he was wrong. So usually there's truth in both sides. The other thing, to add a little humor to this, your first caller is a professional talk show caller, Larry. We hear him all over the West Coast. Thank you.
Okay.
You should keep in mind that there wasn't necessarily a moral equivalency. McCarthy might have been right that there were communists in the government. He also ruined a lot of lives. keep in mind the other side of the equation. While people had no right to take the law or take information into their own hands, most of the people we're talking about who passed information were kind of utopian. They were idealists. Maybe they were misguided. Maybe they never should have thought the way they did, certainly in terms that we think today. But most of them did not do it for money or any other cause. They believed what they were doing was right.
Let's get another caller in. Michelle is on the line with us from Wixom, Michigan.
Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
Well, thank you.
I was born in 1958, and my parents had a set of Life magazine photos. I think each set went in 10-year spans in decades, and within that book was a picture of the execution. Each person within the chair covered from head to toe with a black hood. And at such a young age, I stared at the picture and just imagined what she was feeling. And I asked my mom, how do they know? And she truly believed in her heart that they were doing the right thing and that it would save the country. But I questioned it. And I think because of that picture and it being allowed to be photographed and printed out and sent within the public, it's affected me to this. I get so perturbed when I see certain things, and I weigh everything that I look at, and I don't really think things have changed very much since then. Some of my kids are beeping me. That's what you hear.
Okay.
I'm not sure if you accurately remember that picture. It might have been an artist's conception or something like that. But what it does remind us is how dangerous the death penalty can be, that now we know for a fact, or as close to a fact as we ever can, that Ethel Rosenberg was wrongly executed. You can't make up for mistakes like that.
Right, right. I thought it was actually a Life magazine picture, and all the photos within this book were that. And there she was. I'm sure I have it downstairs because I have all my mom's stuff here.
Well, I think Sam Roberts did a lot of research looking for pictures just like that.
So. I wondered if he had come across it.
No, I haven't.
A tabloid shot or something.
Send it along if you find it.
Okay, I will do that.
And Michelle, thank you very much for the phone call.
Thank you.
When the Rosenbergs were executed in 1953, they left behind two sons. Robert Mirapol, the younger of the two, was 6 years old at the time. Robert afterwards was adopted by Abel and Ann Mirapol, along with his brother Michael. He later became a lawyer, an activist, and founder and executive director of the Rosenberg Fund for Children. He's also an author. His latest book is An Execution in the Family, One Son's Journey. And he joins us now from our bureau in New York. And welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I know that you were brought up to believe that both of your parents were innocent. As all of this has gone on throughout your entire life, I'm sure your views have evolved.
Well, yeah, and in fact, that my book is a lot about the evolution of my views. I grew up believing emotionally that my parents were innocent as a young man, and I studied the case. I became intellectually convinced that they were innocent. We uncovered all this material that showed the judge communicated with the prosecution, that government witnesses lied, that evidence was fabricated. We started piecing together the story of what happened to my mother. But then in the 1980s, I went to law school. And in law school, I realized that while we had shown my parents were framed, that they didn't steal the secret of the atomic bomb, they didn't do the thing they were killed for, I hadn't really proved that they were innocent of the vague conspiracy they were actually charged with. And so when all this new material started coming out in the 1990s, I looked at it with that lens in mind. And I came to the conclusion, as Sam has, that my mother was not a spy of any sort. But I came to a somewhat different conclusion about my father because I placed less faith in the documents, the Venona transcriptions and comments of KGB agents than he does. I think it's possible that Julius Rosenberg is the spy described in the Venona transcriptions. But I also think it's possible that the Venona transcriptions contain a certain amount of disinformation. And so I would describe myself as an agnostic vis-a-vis my father's involvement.
Mm-hmm.
But that, for me, the minute I admit the possibility that he did something, I then have to confront, as his son, how I feel about him possibly engaging in such activity when I was a small child. And that was a very difficult issue for me to confront, and it still is.
As a small child, do you remember your parents, or do you fear sometimes that your memories are sort of, well, corrupted by all of the retelling of the stories?
I think that to some degree they are corrupted. I don't remember anything about our family life before the arrest. I remember visiting them in prison, but I can't distinguish one visit from the next. I remember my mother being short. I remember the visits being calm and quiet. But the reality is I have very little memories of my parents.
There are a lot of letters. I just wanted to read an email before I get to that, though. This is from Paul Liberatore, who emailed us to say, my father worked as a prison guard in New York State Department of Corrections back in the 50s. He told me a story once that a fellow guard who was on watch in the death house while the Rosenbergs were awaiting execution told him how the husband and wife, separated by iron bars and many feet and out of visual contact with each other, would sing to each other and together in a sad and charming attempt to comfort each other. It is hearsay, and that guard has probably long since passed away, but an interesting story nonetheless. And Sam Roberts, entirely consistent with the letters that they wrote.
Entirely consistent, and I believe that story to be true, that was true in the House of Detention, and I think it was also true at Sing Sing. Ethel was or wanted to be a professional singer, in fact.
Hmm. Yeah, and I would corroborate that. I think that that's a true story also.
50 years afterwards, Robert Meeropol, how do people react to you?
Well, I mean, first of all, the name's Meeropol, not Rosenberg, so that unless, you know, my book comes to rival Hillary's or something, they're probably not going to know. The problems I get into with people reacting to me is when, you know, cocktail conversation. Since I'm the executive director of the Rosenberg Fund for Children, if I want to avoid talking about who my parents were, I say, well, I'm a lawyer. Well, but if they ask what I do, I end up being sort of dragged down a road where I finally have to say what the foundation does and who my parents were. And that's a real conversation stopper. It's probably more difficult for the person I'm talking to than me. I'm quite used to it. But, you know, people get used to their situations. It's the reality that I've existed in for decades, and I've come to terms with it.
Well, tell us about the foundation and what does it do?
Well, the Rosenberg Fund for Children is a public foundation that provides for the educational and emotional needs of children in this country who've been targeted or whose parents have been targeted in the course of their progressive activities. What we do is we find young people today who are struggling with the same kind of problems that my brother and I faced after our parents' arrest. And we try to help them by connecting them with summer camps or cultural programs or therapists and the like. This is my sort of my dream job, because it means that all the people who helped me when I was a child, I can't thank them, I can't pay them back. But what I can do is I can pass on the kind of support they gave me to the next generation. And so I see this as far from an altruistic task on my part. I see it more as a privilege to do it. I wake up in the morning and I get to do exactly what I want, and I get a tremendous amount of satisfaction from it. So, you know, I can't ask for more, actually. I consider myself quite lucky at this point, despite my heritage.
We're speaking with Robert Meeropol and Sam Roberts about the Rosenberg case, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get a caller involved. Chris joins us now on the line from San Francisco.
Hi. I was curious about if there was anything known about the relationship between Ethel and Greenglass, her brother who testified against her, because that's I'm wondering if there was if the in-laws were feuding or anything like that. Is there any information about that?
I think the best we can tell is the relationship between brother and sister was very good until the time that business went bad. David Greenglass and Julius Rosenberg had a machine shop together on the Lower East Side. The wives were not at the best of terms. Ruth Greenglass was blaming Julius Rosenberg for the lack of business. David ultimately left the shop. They didn't make much money at all. And there is a theory that some of that bitterness boiled over into the behavior at the trial. We'll never know whether that's actually true or not, but I think Ethel and David growing up, loved each other very much as brother and sister.
Because well, Ethel almost sounds like a sociopathic, guiltless act that Greenglass just had no conscience to deal with there.
Well, I don't think he had a conscience, frankly. He said that the dark cloud of this execution would live over his conscience forever. I don't think that was true because I don't think he had one. But when it's important to remember that when he testified, truthfully or not, and we now know that he lied, I don't think he was in his own mind drawing a direct line between his testimony and his sister being put to death.
Okay.
Yeah, I think I want to add something to that. I think one of the things that I've noticed about David Greenglass, having watched him on television in 2001, as well as reading the book, is that he never seems to have taken responsibility for any of his actions. That seems to be a character trait that goes right through his entire history and to this day.
And that's why one of the things that interested me in doing the book is that ultimately this is a story about family. It's a story about the relationship of, in part, a brother and a sister. And that's one of the reasons I wrote it.
Very good. Thanks.
Thanks for the call, Chris. And let's see if we get one more caller in. Joanne joins us now on the line from Detroit.
Hi. How are you?
Okay.
I was just driving along, and I heard this. My father was an officer of the Communist Party in the late 30s and early 40s through the Stalin purges. But the group that my parents socialized with when I was a little girl, and I'm 64 years old, they were all members of the Communist Party. And so I heard many discussions, and I was pre-adolescent and adolescent. And in the ninth grade, when my father testified at the Smith Act trial, so there were many discussions about the party, what the party was, and in particular about Julius and Ethel Rosenberg and marches with signs. And I remember, I have clear memories of my childhood, so I don't know if I'm older than the Rosenberg children, perhaps I am. But I have a clear memory, and the clear memory I have is of a discussion that I had with my father about the Rosenbergs. And were they involved? It said, were they guilty or not? And he said to me, they were involved, and that the word in the party, because that's what they referred to it as, the party, the word in the party was that they were involved, not necessarily Julius more than Ethel, and not necessarily Ethel more than Julius, but that they were involved. But it was nothing. It was no big deal. It was not the secret of the bomb.
Okay, Joanne, thanks very much for the call. I'm afraid we're going to have to end it there. Sam Roberts, thank you very much for being with us today.
Neil, thank you.
Sam Roberts, a deputy editor at the New York Times, author of The Brother, The Untold Story of the Rosenberg Case. And Robert Meeropol, we thank you for your time today, of course.
Thank you also.
Robert Meeropol is the younger son of Ethel and Julius Rosenberg, the author of An Execution in the Family, One Son's Journey. They were both with us from our bureau in New York. When we come back from a break, the history of the term revisionist history. And later we'll talk with the director of the new documentary, Capturing the Freedmans. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.